Okay, thanks, Rosie. Yeah, he's very good. He's doing very well. Prick, ego, bollocks. Welcome to Avail. I think I might have brought the wrong poems. A lot of my poems are kind of classical music poems. But I will lighten up as we go along. And I was delighted by Rob's poem there. I mean, that was, there are a few violins and glissandi and that kind of thing in my work. This is my second visit to Avail. I was here 8 years ago, and it wasn't a poetry. It was just at the very start. I remember Paul, and we sat at this table here, and there was a workshop by James Harper here, and there was about six of us, and he gave this brilliant workshop in Anglo-Saxon riddles. Now I think maybe you were there. Okay. But I think some of it kind of rubbed off on me, because just in the first poem that I'm going to read, there's a big element of the Anglo-Saxon riddle. In the riddle, it's usually an object telling about itself, and then we kind of have to guess what the object is. So this first poem, it's a riddle, except I've given the answer in the title, but it is an object telling about itself, and it's no kind of ordinary object. It's actually the piano stool or the piano chair used by Glenn Gould, the great Canadian pianist. So it's his chair kind of telling its story. Glenn Gould, he liked to sit low at the piano. He liked to be kind of down looking at the keys. For some reason, he liked his knees to be higher than his backside, whatever that was about. But he had this kind of stool specially made. And it kind of became an icon. It went wherever he went. For 20 years he brought it all over the world. It's now in a glass case in Canada in a museum. So I'll read the poem and Glenn Gould's chair. I was not fooled by his attention-seeking ways. The daft essays, his thing for Petula Clark. I'm just going to say, if you don't know about Glenn Gould, who was eccentric, don't worry, that problem is going to be solved over the next 2 minutes. Glenn Gould's chair. I was not fooled by his attention-seeking ways, the daft essays, his thing for Petula Clark, the out-of-tune humming as he played, not to mention the hand-washing routines, the farcically slow speeds, or me, who he had made specially with screw clamps and a folding bridge chair, all to do with some crackpot notion that his Bach sounded cleaner if his knees were higher than his arse. But I did like him in the early days, when he would suddenly sit straight and gaze heavenward, pink puffs of love whooshing through his soul. The travel too I adored, the fountains of Rome, the scent of a new Bosenstein in the Staatsoper Hall, more than making up for the Goldberg long hours. His dread of being touched, all that fretting over room temperatures. But I drew the line at his techno phase, when the fetish for recording machines meant wholesome days squandered in windowless rooms. I tried everything to keep the boredom at bay, even humming out of tune. No Tweedledee partitas for me, just Frankie Lane giddying up his mule train. And towards the end, the obligatory verse of Good Night, Irene. I had prepared without knowing for the shallowness of his final days in airplane holds and the trunks of cars, reading Kierkegaard, coming to understand my daredevil streak and certain longings which mistakenly I had put down to his prickliness rubbing off on me, but which I now see as nothing more than the purple love I harbour for the things I fear. Like the drone of the lawnmower outside this library, where home is now a glass case, reminding me of glances exchanged on trains, or the heart-stopping touch of anonymous hands bearing me from the wings to the stage. But I am happy to be here, alone at last, with no regrets or nuts to entertain. Just the cues who file past, raving about my legs, or the ghost they sometimes see, still squinnying over invisible keys. I look out benignly and call them rude names under my breath. That is, if I am not off somewhere, dreaming up things to do in my mature phase. Walking on the seashore, hanging out in cafes, painting deathless nudes. Okay. So that it's well worth checking. There's a great archive of Glenn Gould on YouTube. And it's really well worth checking out because he does sing really badly out of tune as he plays, you know. And okay, well, I'm just going to talk about a couple of poems about the sea and money. One of the ways that I got through the recession, or I'm trying to get through the recession, is by going swimming in the sea on a regular basis. I don't know what that's all about, but for some reason, you cannot get out of a cold sea with a negative thought in your head. I think it's something to do with that. As I say, two poems about the sea and money. The second of these poems, I'll admit, it's one of my weirder poems, but I'm just going to do it anyway, so hard luck. I've raided the thesaurus for it. I found various synonyms for money. Pelf, boodle, cowries, words like that. So I kind of had fun like that, and I kind of messed up the syntax a bit. But the first one kind of sets the scene. So all that thing, being hard up, the sea, the cold of the sea, longing, all kind of mixed in there. Immersion. Arms going for heat, he struts out of the sea, a flamingo pink signal man, hoping to be noticed, swimming al fresco in January. Some man, and his dog passed this way moments ago, but saw neither him and his dog paddling, nor the fleece and dungarees left balancing on the shaky-kneed reeds. Some pricks are just so into themselves. The usual relief at feeling his keys plumb in his pocket, the coins for coffee. Okay. Smackers. Across the shell-shock sand barefooting, shekel shekel, the pelf-obsessed clams going, the mussels, the razors, a tide rowing in for amusing himself in, high rollers going, not you, not again, your frozen splurges. Up to his knees in a banker boy sea, its towel snapping with, the towel it's been needing to dry off its aching. Not one of your bigger moods, says he, not one of your history is not made by nothing doing phases. Back answers the sea, a belly smacking with, whoever you're searching, you won't find her here. How to beat that for a slammy? As if the shooting match was nothing with boodle. Nothing to do after that but wade in and lie, sky looking. Cowries crisscrossed with drift cloudings of years. He and she side by side lying, no talk or needing. Before bilkers or cirrus as scuppers to pass back the longing through. Okay, so when I come out of the sea, in all my dripping James Bond irresistibility, you can imagine. About 100 yards up on my right-hand side, there's a hotel. It's a very well-heeled hotel, and it seems to kind of grin and wink at me. But fortunately, for 2.5 months during the winter, the hotel closes, and I reckon one of the reasons it closes, it needs a winter getaway from the kind of clientele it has. But I kind of like to imagine what's going on inside the hotel when it's empty, you know. And again, I suppose it's bringing inanimate things alive, which you can have fun doing in poetry. So after the guests have gone. After the guests have gone, the light gives up on the knitwear outside the ladies, the terraced jewellery display. In the card room, the porter's handcart stands away from the table, a braggart who's lost his shirt. The expensive artworks aren't on speaking terms. Only Buddha overseeing the sea spa is doing his bit to dam up the leaks from the executive suite inside. The pewter taps throbbing with tears for a boy calling daddy up the stairs. All going back to before the potted herbalist, the nonagenarians in their outre leisure wear. Lord Buddha's nerves aren't what they were, not with a skip on the landing and decorators spilling from their transits. That can only mean wasted nights nursing doubles in the arthritic wing, the twins with the view of the bay groaning and lying on their stomachs. Hell isn't the din, but the having to sit and empathize while a room goes on seething at the knife in its side, a minibar aria talked over, a ceiling sulk ignored, pains that refuse to quit their pleading, just let us have our lives. Turning, I listened again to the trees, heard the first hammer blows of the day echoing from the music field around the back. Turning on my side to watch the houses grow, I saw timber-framed men borne skyward. How still they seemed, frozen by the wind or the view of the robust and nourishing harbour. After breakfast, listened again to Schumann getting drunk and throwing money around, until the children awoke and all I could hear all bumpy morning long was the sound of their fairy feet running in and out of the piano. Though at first I mistook the footsteps for the lady with the pastry tray, tea time just after the visitor called. Neither of us spoke as he took me by the hand and led me down the stairs, through the hall, out the blue, blue door, past the bonfires, the harlequin show, the group of men playing cards in the moonlight, until it was just the two of us, stranded again, deep in the unreachable snow. Another poem now with a visitor in it. And this is the visitor from hell. This is the visitor nobody wants. House guest. He still comes to stay after all these years. The same ponytail, the hem of the full-length coat unfrayed. We forget he has a key, but not the routine. The drawing of curtains before he herds us into the front room. The clicking of the lock. The wall-shaking days getting himself installed in the kitchen, stripping the worktops, burning the elements of the kettle, the cuckoo rings. The pornographic magazine slipped under our door as an act of contrition for waking the children with the gas, the upstairs taps left running through their dreams. We're ready to crack by the middle of the second week. We call the police, but no one comes. Serene with fright, we accede to his orders to open the curtains and smile at the postman, the meter reader, the dark-eyed delivery boy with the oriental takeaways we cannot afford. Just act normal, he says, remembering to tell us his one joke about Lutherans being afraid to make love by the window in case people think they're dancing. This as our blood-pricked fingers are scrawling, "Whatever happens, I love you," on rose-patterned walls. If only it weren't for the end of the third week, when the flowers start sprouting from his pockets and every 2 minutes he's in and out with cups of tea, arguing with a soft-spoken authority that Schoenberg's piano concerto is really no more formally than Haydn mixed in with Brahms. If only his hands didn't come so alive on Granny's upright, making their point with such delicacy, such a lamb, that the bigger silence in Debussy should always stay intact, whatever the speed. The world has larger margins than you think, he says, as he puts on his hat and leaves. A slightly, I'm going to ramble during this next introduction, but I will just use my allotted 25 minutes or whatever it is. Hang on. Yeah, I identify with Nannerl Mozart, right? Who is Mozart's younger sister, and she was his older sister. So when she was 7 or 8, she was supremely talented. She was a brilliant harpsichordist, and she showed great inklings towards composition. And she was actually just as talented as Mozart at his age. But when he came along, she was kind of eclipsed by him. And she ended up having quite a sad life, quite a difficult life. I think she ended up, sidelining her music, being involved in difficult relationships, taking care of her father, you know, and a lot of a lot of unused potential was there. So I suppose this is by way of introducing a poem where I try to imagine the Mozart family. Now, Leopold Mozart, the father, he brought his two children like circus animals, really. Now, he wasn't a bad father. He did his best, you know, and he really encouraged them musically. But he dragged them around Europe like performing monkeys, you know, going to the various courts of Europe and playing for the well-to-do. And then he brought them to London at one stage. And just being in this building here, I kind of imagine this is the kind of place where he rented rooms, and like for 3 hours on a Saturday afternoon, Wolfgang and Nannerl would be there, you know, and they'd be playing blindfolded, you know, they'd be doing all the party tricks, and people would kind of pay a fiver and go up to watch these so-called miracles of nature, you know. So they kind of had it tough in a way. So I'm just imagining them in Calais before they actually cross over to England. And just, I'm imagining Nannerl, she would have been about 12 years old, and I'm thinking maybe, of course her father and Mozart was there as well, Wolfie, he was about 8 or 9, but I'd say she's just beginning to get inklings at this stage that things aren't going to work out exactly the way I wanted, you know, these dreams of composition that she had. Having said all that, I'm going to lead into that poem with another short poem. And it's a poem, again, about somebody's failed relationship with music. It's a relationship with a pianist who has failed to master the piano, who is actually sinking the piano physically in a river. And then they sit in the car afterwards, listen to the radio. So, sinking the piano, followed by a Nannerl Mozart poem. Sinking the piano. I would like to, sorry, this is the person is addressing the piano here that they have failed, that they've had this troubled relationship with. Sinking the piano. I would like to stay and share a joke about how far we have come from the plush of the sitting room. Make fun of people we have known, the examiner from the Associated Board, who even as you go down, I see shouting tally-ho from your bow. Or slag you off about your distaste for bottle flies in the embrasure. Your famous hauteur, the days I did not know whether to play you or ask for your autograph. Or, in a different key, confide how this morning, heaving you down the stairs, I thought for the first time of my heart as a poor, neglected creature, and of the poignancy of men shouldering unbearable things. How I nearly cried lashing you to the blue trailer. And again when John McCormack came on with his macushlas while we were reversing you into your grave. And when it was over, sitting at this cove, hearing something of you still in the traffic reports, the hourly news, the biographer from our London studios with her sad, alluring talk of Mozart's sister Nannerl, whose musical lights went out as her brother took center stage. And now the Nannerl poem. Nannerl, who never became a composer, sees the sea for the first time. Calais, 1764, en route to London. A thing that runs away and comes back, not all it's cracked up to be. Papa in his impresario coat saying we're too indoorsy. Eyes closed, I want to know it through my ears. But can an ocean really be a clavier rattling on the roof of a coach? Papa, I need to compose. Not that again. Where do you get your notions? And what of Wolfie? Sick from travel, yet chipper enough to be tickled by the pooping waves and farting foghorns. Does he see how alive he is in Papa's mind? Alive is the seabird gone under to breathe again the slow world solitariness. A berth in the husk, a desk, a skeleton sketch. A poem now about transgression, about a man who has transgressed not necessarily sexually, but who has gone to the mountain, to the giant who lives in the mountain, to seek absolution, and then who has come home to his family. Giant. Then it's you and the music maker inside who insist the show must go on. The cellist in the decimated square, taking on God with the unadorned argument of Albinoni's adagio, focusing only on his bow's cargo of the women and men forever queuing for bread. How to wait your turn and simply abide, not always listening ahead for the next hummable melody, evading the uninterrupted humming from the depths, which lends the surface tune an old enough to be sacred bloom of innocence. Like someone taking your hand and saying it's time to go and face the mountain. Not in a plaintive way, more like a blessing or an echo from a holy place where men learn to live with their mistakes. But what of the mountain giant, his mooncalf stare? It's tell them I came but no one answered strain of loneliness. A gaze so ardent for news of a thaw in the valley below, you hardly notice the mystical flame of his smile, the clemency it bestows, turning you to such a scatterbrain, such a tongue-tied nuisance, you're afraid he'll bend over like Hafiz's god and comb you into his hair. The slipshod ways, the ingratitude, the cliched furnishings which constitute your home, all falling away like ploofs of snow from the rumpled boots you'll set to dry in the back hallway, beside the roller skates, the purple school bag passed out on the tiles like a child's disowned shadow. Outside, the street is as calm and inscrutable as the night you left. The dark music of parked cars, houses with nothing to sing about, yet which speak with an inwardness you take comfort in. The halo of reserve of things that have failed and been forgiven. Waking to the ping of the microwave, a house acting as if there's nothing to be explained. All you can hear is the rain. You feel it for what it is, an afterpain, a giant absence. The shot-up forest with blackened clearings, craters, contrails over the hopelessly far-off mountain, spelling out in luminous script how a thing will invoke its opposite. The cellist in the shade of the rubble square, attacking each downbow as if to say, I shall never get this piece. I only know it exists. The spray of loose strife on a mantelpiece, seeding in children's eyes as a voyage with monsters. A man who'll laugh like a boy again, look up from his path to drink the sky like a giant's wine. Okay, while speaking of children, I'm going to read a poem now that's not by you. That's not one of my own. It's by the one and only Shel Silverstein, right? Who's written terrific comic verse, you know, both for adults and children. And I'll kind of explain later why I'm reading it. When I was your age, my uncle said, "How do you get to school?" I said, "By bus," and my uncle smiled. "When I was your age," my uncle said, "I walked it barefoot, 7 miles. My uncle said, "How much weight can you tote?" I said, "One bag of grain." My uncle laughed. "When I was your age," my uncle said, "I could drive a wagon and lift a calf." My uncle said, "How many fights have you had?" I said, "2, and both times I got whipped." "When I was your age," my uncle said, "I fought every day and was never licked." My uncle said, "How old are you?" I said, 9 and a half. And then my uncle puffed out his chest and said, "When I was your age, I was 10. Okay, well, no, and that's kind of leading in. I'm of that generation, you know, that actually heard the words that children are should never be heard, but should only be seen. Okay. But now getting older, I begin to realize that even people who might have said that and who believed it, I think as they get into grandparenthood, they couldn't have believed it. You know, because I do see, I think people are suspicious of children who don't talk, you know. I mean, there's something, they like their children to talk. They like to hear stories from children. So this is kind of, I won't go into how it came about. I didn't have to do very much writing on this next poem, but it's kind of on that idea, a relationship between an older person who really wants to hear a younger person talk, a young grandchild. I know you're a quiet boy, but it can't go on like this. So I will ask again. Your news for today? A fight, maybe? Yes. In your school? Yes. Hardly in your class. Not a fight in your class. Yes. A fight in your class. And somebody hurt, maybe? Was somebody hurt? Yes. Somebody hurt today in your class in a fight. Yes. Boy, oh boy. And how is the poor lad? Dead. Okay, on a slightly more melancholy note, going back to then that thing about good children, or quiet children should always be seen and never heard. And tying that in with the suffocation that might go with that kind of an upbringing. And bringing back the piano again. And it's called Advice on a Musical Evening. Never dress up a child to play the piano. Never let the doctor blow cigar smoke in his hair. Never offer the padre more Matthias Rosé after the child has started to play. Never say, don't bang, or quieter please, so the guests can get on with their talk. Or announce, that was lovely dear, except your shirt was sticking out. Never stuff a child inside a piano when he lets slip about you-know-whose operation. And when dispatching guests at the door, never leave child and padre alone. As for you, dear padre, never forget, in another man's house, there's an etiquette. Never ogle a child from his father's chair, as the giddy goodbyes float up through the stairs. Or with steepled fingers, one eyebrow raised, never say, this is only a suggestion, but have you ever tried playing standing up? And when the boy in his wounded confusion obliges, keep your slinky hands to yourself. Oh, one more. Okay. Final poem then. It's the closest I've got to a love poem. I'll just read it short. My woman. My woman do not understand the need for so much solitude in my life. Because there are things my woman do never see. My woman take no interest in the plexities of strife or the unexpected elations among wings that do occur from rhyme time to rhyme. Because my woman is like that. My woman take no pride in the starships that come parking upstairs or in the breathing spaces that do naturally appear after each unloading, though sometimes it can take a while. My woman, you see, want everything ubbity-dubbity. Hey, let's, how about yous and these and me's and yous messing up my plexities, always giving me pause. My woman is. Thank you.